The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Good morning, and good afternoon, and good day. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your News Dissector. This is News Dissector Radio, heard 1 p.m. We're a little bit late here, running a little behind, on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. We're thrilled that you could join us. We're going to be talking with Greg Pallas, the journalist. Ellen Brown is sticking around. Sherry Welsh is on hold. Erin Crown will be joining us. It'll be an hour packed with information you rarely hear anywhere else. It'll be an hour worth listening to. You can join us online, and also you can join us by calling 888-874-4888. This is the Progressive Radio Network.com.
To chase and to walk home.
Well, that was the theme song from In Debt We Trust. Ellen, I wanted you to hear it. I hope you were able to. Ellen is joining us from Southern California. Greg Pallas will be joining us in his car as he drives in from New York. Greg, are you there? Good morning. Good afternoon. Hello.
I'm here.
Greg Pallas is with us as well. So, Greg, stand by for a second, because Ellen Brown was on with Gary Noll, and she's sticking around for a minute or two. I just wanted to ask you one question, Ellen. You know, you were really early on critiquing this whole debt crisis in America. Your book, Web of Debt, is a brilliant exegesis, whatever, however you say that, of the problem. You know, you've been offering all sorts of not only critiques but also suggestions for what could be done with state banks, with rethinking about how money is considered on Yes Magazine and in other places. And I just wanted you to give me a sense of where you think we are as a country. You think people are more open to hear these ideas and to understand this critique?
I definitely think people are more open to hearing it. Everyone knows now that we have a problem. My concern is that the government and the major media are sweeping it under the rug. They think that it'll destabilize the system, which means destabilize the banks, if we try to change anything. So that's why I keep writing that this was not just sloppiness on the part of the banks, that they were concealing a massive fraud, and we need to put somebody in jail, or at least need to have some investigations here. They were actually pledging those mortgages to more than one set of investors. They were basically doing the same thing they did with gold 100 years ago, where it was like fractional reserve lending, but they're using this real estate to make extra loans. So really, the real estate was just pledged as security. So they're figuring, well, most of them aren't going to default, and when they do, we'll pull that out of the pool and foreclose on it, and then we'll get the money for that, and then it can go back in the pool. So that's why the reason they didn't assign the paperwork straight out of the gate like they should have was that they were saving the paper. They didn't know who it was going to wind up with. In fact, it wound up with a number of sets of investors, and that's why you had several, in some cases, you have more than one party trying to foreclose on this real estate because they all think it's security for their loan.
Well, this whole crisis is getting deeper. It's getting in a way more interesting. It's also not being talked about by most of the mainstream media. It's not being talked about by the political candidates and the political parties. You would think this foreclosure crisis would have people, politicians, jumping up and down to help Americans save their homes, but we're not seeing that. We're we're planning, Ellen, to start a campaign, what we're calling the jailout campaign, as opposed to the bailout campaign. We'd love you to join us as part of, you know, my efforts to get my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, seen, and my new book, The Crime of Our Time. We are going to be posting a petition on the internet, giving people a chance to share their thinking and to support this effort. I think there are a lot of people who will. I hope you will, Ellen. I hope that we can have you on and have a real discussion with you sometime in the future. If I can ever, you're too popular, it seems, for me to kind of get a word in elsewhere, edgewise, but I'm trying. So thank you, Ellen Brown. And please, people, read this book, Web of Debt. Follow her work on the internet. It's very important. She's an attorney. She's also a brilliant analyst of these issues. She knows how to write about it in a way that's really engaging. She's not one of these, you know, eco-speak people who only writes for other economists. She writes for ordinary people, and she does a great job of it. So I just wanted to give a little plug to you, Ellen. Thank you. At least I had a chance to say hello, and I'll tell you more about this campaign and get your thinking about how we can make it much bigger. So that was Ellen Brown. Now, from the Long Island Expressway, we're joined. But before we go there, Ellen, the dissectress, Sherry Welch, are you with us this morning?
But of course.
I keep calling it the morning because my show used to be on in the morning, but it's now on in the lunch hour. And Sherry Welch, meet Greg Palast.
It's morning in Los Angeles and Hawaii.
meet Greg Palast. Sherry's one of your biggest fans, Greg, and your work, and she was thrilled that you agreed to come on. I realize it's a little awkward because you're, you know, kind of barreling into the big city from, you know, your basic bunker out on Long Island. So, but I wanted to you know, just this morning there's this big revelation somehow that the concrete in the deep water horizon well was known to be volatile. And so now, you know, the government report seems to be blaming Halliburton for this particular part of the problem. You've studied this in detail. You've been working on DP and DP issues for years now. How do you react to this latest disclosure, or is it really a disclosure?
Danny Schechter, my hero in media, and by the way, I just heard from some guys from Kazakhstan where I'm going. They said, "Do you know Danny Schechter?" So you are famous in Kazakhstan, truly. And that's a good reason. I before I was a journalist at BBC, I was an investigator. I spent years investigating Exxon Valdez breakups for the Chugach natives who actually owned the shoreline that was cracked on up there. And what I found was that it wasn't Exxon which had destroyed the coastline, you know, even though I'm not letting them off the hook, but British Petroleum, which had no system. It was British Petroleum, not Exxon, which was responsible to make sure that if there's ever a spill, that it would be contained. It's not rocket science. You just have to get some rubber stuff around the oil spill, or either blown-out rig or a ship. You put the rubber around it, and then you get a sucker thing, and, you know, you have this, like, big, giant oil prophylactic, you know, a big rubber, and you suck it out, and that's it. And if they had done that, British Petroleum, they would have, you've never heard of the Exxon Valdez. Maybe it would have been like page 7, you know, a picture with a caption one day, and that would have been it. But British Petroleum, which said that they would have the equipment out, which said they would have that rubber out, and those sucker ships called containment barges, they didn't. They absolutely, simply, completely lied. It was a fraud, a massive fraud. And they got away with it. And that's why you have the Deepwater Horizon problem, because they got away with it in Alaska. British Petroleum was in charge. They operate there not under the name British Petroleum, but under the name Alyeska, because it was considered a real bad idea to have a non-American British Petroleum own most of the oil of Alaska, which they do. So they got away with it. They paid $125 million from the industry's insurance fund, and not a penny out of their own pocket, and they got the idea that you could save billions and billions and billions of dollars by simply not spending money on safety. And that if something goes wrong, hey, they can figure out a way to politically get out of the whole thing, as they did in Alaska. So that was the lesson of Alaska, and that was the crime. So now you see they got the cement. Okay, now we're getting into damage control. Let's blame Halliburton. Let's blame Transocean. Yeah, by the way, they're all to blame because they're all in on it. But that doesn't let BP off the hook. In fact, it was interesting, Danny. I was cleaning out old files yesterday and found a 21-year-old article from the Wall Street Journal that I had saved. Interestingly, it was British Petroleum saying offshore drilling, British Petroleum, offshore drilling will now be safe because we've got all the systems in place in case there's ever a blowout. That's 21 years ago.
Brilliant. How soon we forget.
The promise, and then they got the approval for the offshore drilling based on that promise, and here we are today.
Well,
and by the way, they said that they had, don't forget, it's BP, even if Halliburton put in the wrong cement, it's BP which ordered the cement. And I'm not letting Halliburton off the hook. They knew that they were selling, that BP was on for the cheap product, and Halliburton was willing to go along. It's like, imagine if you had a fire department, and by the way, oil spill response is like a fire department for the ocean. Imagine if you had a fire department where the fire chief, it's a private fire department, and the private fire department says, well, you know, we could save money if we get these, like, really, instead of real hoses that use for fire, we'll just use the, you know, the garden hoses. Then the building's on fire, and they say, well, geez, bad hoses. Well, we're going to blame the contractor.
Well, there you go. You know, it seems to be a stunning lack of accountability here, lack of understanding who they were dealing with, lack of responsibility on not only the part of the government and the people supposedly in charge of monitoring all of this, but of course the companies themselves and the media, which has done such a poor job in bringing this out. I just wanted to mention, and I'm blanking out here, Sherry, so help me out. What's the program on Comedy Central, you know, with the little people that look like little toys that are on, that, you know, it's the Daily Show, before the Daily Show. It's a... No, it's a...
I'm kidding.
It's a... What? What is it again? South Park. Last night had a brilliant parody of BP. They called it DP, and they had the president continually saying, I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. It was a stunning political analysis in the form of a kind of parody of a children's show that was brilliant, and you should see it when you can. I'm sure it's up on their website. It takes on this issue in a very stunning way that I thought you'd be interested in. But, you know, how well is, I mean, the media is making up for its poor coverage, isn't it? I mean, PBS just did a brilliant hour on Frontline looking into all of this, didn't they, Greg?
You mean the petroleum broadcast system?
Yeah.
If you look at the PBS website, and if you look at the PBS website and you look at the NewsHour, and you will see on top of it the Chevron oil logo. BP made a mistake. It cut its funding of PBS a couple years ago, and it was taken over. That funding was replaced by Chevron. And that's what you saw. What the film that PBS Frontline did, which is called The Spill, looked like it had been written by Chevron's PR department because it ran the Chevron line. Chevron has been running full-page ads saying BP is bad, it was preventable, it's their fault. We shouldn't have a moratorium on drilling, on offshore drilling. The industry is safe. We're prepared for a spill. And by the way, every one of these statements is a complete, total, absolute lie. But PBS went for it hook, line, and sinker, including repeating like seven times. Literally, I counted in their show, in the Frontline show, seven times they used the phrase that the problem was British Petroleum's corporate culture. You know, they don't have no culture, Danny. That was the problem. As opposed to an industry culture. Now, I got to tell you, if you go to gregpalace.com, you can see this thing I wrote called the petroleum broadcast system owes us an apology. But what would really be valuable is to take a look at my film, Pelts Investigates, and you can see part of this for nothing, about Chevron in the Amazon. And you'll see natives there farmers there in the Amazon who have pustules all over their bodies. You'll see graveyards of little kids who are dead of leukemia from the damage caused by oil left by Chevron's Texaco unit. So let me ask you about the corporate culture of BP and the corporate culture of Chevron. And by the way, PBS even had, they went so far as to actually have the chairman of Chevron on the show saying that he was not like BP, and BP didn't act to the industry standard.
This is really it's a little distressing, because also this organization ProPublica, which is a public interest media research group funded with nonprofit money, some good reporters there, including the son of a friend of mine, a veteran journalist, was also involved in this broadcast. There was a partnership between PBS and the ProPublica. And one of the things that, one of the criticisms I read was the problem with it was it just wasn't long enough.
Long enough? What, so they could have more of Chevron? They had Chevron in there. They had Shell. They had, they had Exxon. All saying how wonderful they were. Their corporate culture was not BP's. So it was a show, the whole show was an exercise in damage control, of saying, don't stop us from drilling offshore, even though we have no idea how to do deep water. Don't stop Shell Oil from drilling in the Arctic Ocean, which is what they want to do. Don't, we are good boys, and Chevron does more deep water drilling in the Gulf than BP. And I got to tell you, I was just down there filming. Chevron's destruction of the Gulf far, far exceeds the damage of the BP spill.
Wow.
The BP.
Did you know
spill
that, Sherry?
Is horrific.
Yeah, I follow Greg's columns pretty closely, and I read about how he was with his dog the other night on PBS, and it's astounding what they have done.
Yeah, and what's happened is that Chevron, for example, and Shell have removed 4 million cubic yards of the Delta wetland, destroyed this barrier. And by the way, that was the immediate cause of the drowning of New Orleans, according to the Hurricane Center at the LSU, was the loss of the wetlands, right?
What did they call that?
That was caused not by BP, but by Chevron and Shell.
What did they call that mechanism, Greg, that they, there's a, the name that you have in your documentary?
Well, they have, there's a few things. They have.
It wasn't the monster, it was called something. What was it called?
You mean the special inlet that they created?
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Mr. Go.
Mr. Go.
There are two things. Yeah, I was just flying down there, charter plane, took out the old head of the Hurricane Center at LSU, and we saw the damage of BP, number one. I mean, it's 6 months later, by the way, wonderful BP. I'm not letting them off the hook. I was on islands where they could pick up, tons of oil just sitting there all over the place. It's 6 months, man. So I'm not letting BP off the hook.
And not only that, Greg, let me just jump in for a second. Yeah. The dispersants are creating a lot of sickness. Dar Jamal just had a piece on Al Jazeera. He's a great reporter, investigative journalist.
Yeah.
He just had a really major investigation of the use of these dispersants, which was supposed to break up the oil, but in fact they're contributing not only to the ecological problems, but to the health problems of people in that region. It's pretty shocking, and it's ongoing.
Well, yeah. First of all, if you watch, it's the Agent Orange story all over again. They were bombing the oil slick from the air. Now, just so you know, the article I read 21 years ago, has BP saying we can always use dispersants, so you won't see any oil on the beaches. Okay.
I thought because we have Google, they could just Google, the background on this, and they would know all about what happened to this article from 21 years ago. Is that pre-Google?
Well, I have to tell you that I thought that the PBS investigation was investigation by Google. They revealed nothing. They simply went after the Texas refinery explosion, which is a much-told, much-reported story, but leaving out absolutely nothing about the industry's way of operating.
The
destruction of the Gulf is an industry-wide greed factory It's a greed factory mined by the Shell, Chevron, BP, and ConocoPhillips. Those are the four that are responsible for the destruction of the Gulf. And when the other three companies have now formed, by the way, they have all these full-page ads saying that they have now formed a consortium so that they can respond to an oil spill. Well, that's, and they're so proud of it. They're spending $1 billion, and they're leaving BP out, right? Well, I got to tell you, here's a question I have for these guys. You were operating without this before? You told us, I have it in the congressional record. I have it at the EPA in signed, sworn statements that they already had this billion-dollar response operation. So why are they running ads now saying, we're going to have it? They promised they wouldn't drill without it. In other words, they are lying, and the so-called investigation by PBS was just the opposite. It was saying Conoco, Chevron, Shell, Exxon, they're all wonderful guys with wonderful so-called corporate cultures. It's not about corporate cultures. It's about oil industry greed, taking shortcuts, saving money on environmental and human and worker safety.
Well,
one
thing they're not lying about is in the paper today. Exxon is reporting a 50% increase in its profits because the price of oil has gone up mysteriously, and that this is affecting all the oil industry, all the American oil companies, I guess BP as well, are making money hand over fist now. And of course, this money, you know, is just more the wages of crime and slime.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, I actually did a calculation because I'm an energy economist. It's one of my specialties. And in 2006, this is not much reported, BP shut down the Alaska pipelines because they had massive leaks and corrosion. And they had this massive leaks and corrosion for 10 years at least. They chose the absolute peak of the driving time in August in America, right? They chose the absolute peak of oil usage in the middle of the Iraq war to shut down that pipe. The price of oil leaked immediately by $4 a barrel. And what I calculated was the cost of the pipeline fix to BP was something like $150 million. But they made 10 times that much because they shut it down at the perfect time to spike the price of oil worldwide. Yeah, so these guys basically, you have a shutdown in the Gulf, and because they're monopolies, they actually make money from it. So you have a moratorium on drilling in the Gulf, and you just squeeze the price of oil, and it goes up. You know, they win. Slime you, they win. Don't slime you, they win.
You know, Greg.
Well, Greg, I have a question. What is...
Yeah. Sherry, watch the time. Watch the time, Sherry. Watch the time.
I know, it's 1:26.
We're almost at our break. Go ahead, ask your question.
What's Ken Salazar doing about getting rid of this corruption?
Ken Salazar is a toy and a tool of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, you know, it was tragic. You know, Obama takes out a sitting Democratic senator and leaves that vulnerable, or at least he could have done some good. He's not the worst, okay? But he comes from Colorado. It's an oil operation. And he was Mr. Offshore Drilling because... In Colorado, onshore drilling, as you might imagine, in Colorado, is very unpopular. So he's always pushed the offshore drilling.
Greg,
that's why, yeah.
I just wanted to get one thing in here because we're coming up to our break time, and I know you're about to get into the HOV lane, you know,
yeah.
on the Long Island Expressway.
And I'm going to have to leave you.
And running out of battery. But I just want to ask you one thing, you know, trick or treat, you know, it's Halloween. And also, it's the election on Tuesday. And, you know, the Onion headline says, Democrats, if we're going to lose, let's go down running away from every legislative accomplishment we've made. What's your reaction? Is there a connection between Halloween and the election?
Yeah, it's quite spooky. The problem is, yeah, we're getting tricked, not treated. Exactly. And that's the problem. It's all a con. It's all a mask. All these guys are running around saying BP, BP when it's the industry. And
well,
that's the problem.
Well, listen, Greg Pallas, thanks so much for joining us at the very last minute and being on the program this morning. We really appreciate it. We know that you're in transit, as they say. Your writing on this issue is very important because you've been tracking it for so many years, and most of the people haven't. They don't know the context. They don't know the background. They don't ask the questions that need to be asked.
Because they don't want to.
There you go. GregPallas.com is the website. Our Madhouse, I believe, is the last book, and there's a new one coming, and I hope you'll be back with us soon. I must admit, by way of disclosure, Greg Pallas and I go back a ways, and I've learned so much from him in terms of not only his work, but his way of popularizing his work so that people respond to it. That's very important with investigative reporting.
It's Danny's fault, by the way, dear listeners, that I'm even a journalist, because I was just an economist, and he said, you know, you ought to get on TV. And I said, not on your life. See what's happened?
Well, here he is.
Your
Greg,
fault.
Greg Pallas. We'll be back in a few minutes.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold. When Wall Street stepped into the fold, Congress paid off, workers laid off. Stanford, AIG, and laid off. Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets and empty shops. Then bank walking to AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
The Progressive Radio Network, your premier progressive radio station.
Tune in to Cities Grace Notes, where we'll be bringing you inspired voices from around the world. Creative voices from various fields and backgrounds. New sounds, new music, and new ideas with your host, CD. Every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Gary Knoll. I've been on the radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Wherever you go, whenever you do, your debts will accrue and give us a happy glow.
Well, the song is Plastic Fantastic. It's from In Debt We Trust, the film I made in 2006, Warning of the Financial Crisis. The original, the song you heard at the top of the show, Plunder, is the theme song of my film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. It's a subject I'm continuing to follow. And in fact, as I just announced in the last half hour, we're about to launch a campaign, a petition on the internet, essentially calling for not a bailout, but a jailout. We want to see the people involved in this financial crisis who caused the destruction of the American economy, of jobs and of people's homes, brought to justice. We need an investigation. We need an indictment of these individuals. We need a prosecution and a trial and incarceration. If you lived in some other countries where there's corruption by officials, and I'm thinking now of the People's Republic of China, some of these people are basically put to death. I'm not sure we want to do that, but there is a feeling, you know, that the public needs to be protected against this type of massive corruption. Speaking of which, you may not have seen this. The New York Times a week ago told a story about Iran, somebody in Iran putting money in a paper bag and having it brought to Hamid Karzai in Afghanistan, bundles of money, and Karzai sort of admitted it. It was front page in the New York Times. But what's not front page in the New York Times is a new report that's just come out basically saying that $18 billion, that's billion dollars, is missing in the allocations of money for reconstruction aid in Afghanistan. They don't know where it went. They don't know how it was spent. They don't know, you know, what its impact is. And this is the auditors talking. This is U.S. government money, $18 billion, at a time when our economy is in the toilet, at a time when people are furious about what's happening. This is a report of industrial-sized corruption. This is not some money in a paper bag going to somebody in a plane from Iran. This is a pipeline of money coming out of Washington, D.C., $18 billion unaccounted for. The auditors can't find the trail. They don't know how it was spent. And this shocking development is not page one news in the New York Times. So, and it's not an issue in our election. You know, the war in Iran, the war in Afghanistan is barely being mentioned by either of the parties, and not just on a humanitarian basis, but, you know, on the fact that so many Americans oppose these wars now, something like 69% are against them, and nobody wants to talk about them, but the wars continue. And I talked about this in terms of the WikiLeaks disclosures, but there's much more to it. Why is that, Sherry? What are we missing here?
That's a really good question, Danny. And I think that the American public is worn out. We're coming up on the 10th anniversary of shock and awe in Iraq. And I don't know if you remember, but on September 10th, of 2001, the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Pentagon. I don't understand. Don't they use QuickBooks? I do.
Yeah, I mean, can't they follow all this? This is, you know, this is something that's so bizarre. And I think the best person to comment on this bizarreness in our politics, this absurdity, this, you know, in a sense, every day is Halloween because all the politicians are wearing masks and costumes, is somebody from another country. And I happen to have such a person in the studio with me today, a student at Rutgers University, graduate student who I met at a conference on the media and terrorism in London, England. Her name is Jing Ning. She gave a presentation that was very brilliant. I moderated the panel, fought with her, wrap it up, make it shorter, but she didn't listen to me at all. She just went ahead with her findings, and I was very impressed by that, her commitment to her scholarship. Jing Ning, you're here. I want to ask you about your project, but I also want you to give me your reaction to what you're observing in American politics. I mean, you know, we've all been denouncing, you know, in a way, Americans have grown up, you know, denouncing communism, authoritarianism, you know, politics in China. Now you've been exposed to politics in America. How do you absorb it? How do you understand it?
Thank you, Danny. This is a really good question. But actually, I've been keep thinking about the answer for a long time because I came over in 2006 to your country, and I've been watching over what is there on the television show and what's there in the politics, in the entire field of the politicians' talk, the politicians' show, all about those kind of the conversing of the people's idea. I realized that it's a sharp difference between what is happening here in your country and what is happening there in China, because in Chinese political system, we believe that it is kind of what we call a one-party political system dominated by the Chinese Communist Party, and then they do not allow any kind of other challenges, and this is so much like the ideologically controlling part. However, in your country here, what I'm understanding for the political systems running is that they are relying too much on the money side. This is what all the big politicians, they are actually connected with money, and they really run not for the sake of the people of America. They are running for the sake of the big cooperative or the conglomerates that they are running, and then they want to protect their interests rather than the public. So I would say, well, in the essence, to the bottom line, I think that there are not so much differences between what is happening here in America or what's there in China, because Chinese governments are saying that they represent the people's interests. And then I believe that here in the democratic American system, you also are believing that your government should represent the people's opinion. However, you see that they are under different names, but the aftermath, but the result is almost the same.
You're absolutely on target here, quite brilliant, actually. You know, occasionally on the Time Warner cable, you can see CCTV television. It's not as flashy, certainly, as some of the American networks, but they actually spend time explaining an issue, and they analyze it, and you hear from people who are well-informed about it. We don't know anything about it. I mean, our relationship with China is the number one economic reality facing our futures and our country. It's been reduced to a caricature, as if China is bad, America is good, when in fact, they're working together and so on so many fronts and in so many ways, and that we don't really understand the relationship. It really isn't reported very much. When was the last time you heard really a report that explained to you these currency issues, this trade issues, China's position on a lot of these things, how China, by buying up American treasury notes, has kept the American economy from going into a total depression? We don't hear about that. We are dependent on China right now. Now, should we be? Maybe not. Should this be questioned and debated? Probably. But it's not being even mentioned. That's the problem here. It's mentioned on page 58 of the New York Times, way in the back in the business section. It's not really examined in any detail. And that's why I think, Jing, you really should be speaking to these issues, because Americans would learn a lot from you. Just briefly, what is your research? What is your work that you've been analyzing and doing?
When you met me on the conference, remember that you were the panelist and you just tried to stop me for talking too much. That was a small...
Me? Ever? Sherry, can you believe that I would do such a thing?
Sherry, believe me that he was trying to do that. He gave me the shushing sign. He gave me the kind of
not
stop.
The shushing sound. Sherry, not me. I mean...
No, not maybe, you, Danny.
Maybe I was so
never.
Persistent. Yeah, but he was persistent too, so you see. He tried to stop.
You're a good match for each other.
Oh, she's wonderful, and I learned so much from her. But tell the audience, aside from what an idiot I am, tell them what you've been working on.
You are not idiot, absolutely not. You are just a kind of the persistent role of stopping a very stubborn woman.
I know. Okay. No, wait a minute. I was trying to keep the trains moving on time. But what research have you been doing there at Rutgers?
I'm interested in doing content analysis research on the Iraq war reporting. The one you were with me on the conference was on Saddam Hussein, how CNN reported on Saddam Hussein's news about the capturing of him, about the put on trial of him, and it's both image and television transcript analysis. And what I'm doing now for my PhD research in Rutgers University is also a textual analysis of CCTV 9. We have English language TV channel in China, and then that is where I used to work as a managing director for the news program. And I'm interested in seeing from what the CCTV 9, that English channels work during the Iraq War, as a kind of try to find what the cultural and ideological aspect that revealed from the Iraq War reporting.
Well, let me just give you my observation, because mm-hmm. I was observing it, and I actually had written about it, but I had to edit out stuff in my book, because not only do I talk too much, but I write too much. But I was impressed that CCTV, when it was covering an issue not involved with China, in other words, there was no like political people watching over them to make sure that they took the right line. But when they actually were in the field reporting, they did a brilliant job of going to hospitals, telling the story of the Iraqi people and the suffering that they were going through under Saddam Hussein and then under the Americans. And CCTV's coverage was better, in my opinion, than CNN's coverage of this same episode. And I worked at CNN. So I have to say, this is an important subject. You know, Americans have an amnesia. You know, something happens and they forget about it. We just heard about a report 21 years ago about BP that was totally forgotten. You know, so the truth can be out there, but, you know, nobody pays attention to it. But at any rate, Jingning, thank you for stopping by on the show. Stay with us right now. We have a really brilliant financial analyst coming in from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm trying to cover a lot. They only give me an hour on the air here, so I've got to cram a lot in. By the way, next Tuesday night, I've just talked with Gary Noll. We're going to do an election special, an analysis about what's going on. I'm going to also be seen on Al Jazeera television on election. They've called me, invited me to be a commentator about the economy and the election, so I'm very pleased about that. And I've also been appearing on other outlets, Russia Today. I've been appearing on Press TV out of Iran and Democracy Now! And Grit TV. So I'm trying to do what I can do, and also this show on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. And I do my blog every day at NewsDissector.com/blog. So I'm a busy beaver. I welcome your reaction and comments. Aaron joining us. Are you in Atlanta, Aaron?
I'm in D.C. today.
He's in D.C. This is a man who seems to be commuting between the city that was too busy to hate, Atlanta, G.A., and Washington, D.C. And, you know, we're in a situation today where it looks like the Federal Reserve Bank next week is going to announce a new stimulus, probably after the election, without calling it a stimulus. What's going on there? Because they apparently, according to a piece about Bernanke in the New York Times today, he's very distressed that nothing is really helping to fix the economy, that Congress has abdicated all responsibility, and if the Republicans win, they'll probably abdicate more responsibility, in this. They're even talking about a possible shutdown of the U.S. government this spring. What is going on here with this? I mean, how serious is this crisis that we're in?
Well, it's what we, you know, you and I and others that are like-minded have been saying for 2 years now, which is that they're really not fixing the core problems and not forcing, you know, the big banks that need to take the losses and probably go bankrupt and to really settle massive fraud in the housing sector with the homeowners that were defrauded and the investors that were defrauded, and now that's coming to light. So, you know, what the government's doing is trying to double or triple down on a modus operandi that it has not worked and is not working and could not have worked. We, you know, this the economic elites in this country made fun of Japan for the last 15 years for these kind of policies of propping up the big banks and other big companies with, quantitative easing, which is just money printing directed at the people who should be receiving it the least. So we're doing the same thing here now. That's the great irony.
Two articles of interest that I saw. One is on Truthout called Foreclosure Explained by Peter White. He says scandal is spreading across Wall Street like a very bad case of poison ivy. A rash of fraudulent home foreclosures has exposed some of the nation's biggest banks to an even worse condition. Bankruptcy.
Right.
That's on Truthout. This morning on Naked Capitalism, there's a piece by Joe Costello, who is the communications director for Jerry Brown's 1992 presidential campaign and a senior advisor for Howard Dean's efforts in 2004. And he writes, he says, make no mistake, folks, there's a criminal element atop our financial industry who operate with both the complicity and culpability of much of our political class. And until we reform our politics and the financial industry, we will not have economic vitality, and we will not have reform until it is demanded and undertaken by the American people. That is
right.
Where we are. End quote.
Right.
And, you know, talk about corruption in China. You know, China has very little to teach us in the corruption department, it seems to me. I mean, yes, there's pervasive corruption there, but it's political. You know, it's, you're politically connected to the party. There's nepotism. There are princelings. There are people who, you know, are tied into the politicians. But the same thing is true here. And what we're
right.
seeing in this election, $2 billion raised for the election of Congress, okay, you see it at a time when our economy is in distress, you see an example of what's happening here.
I have a question for Aaron.
Yeah.
Aaron, did you happen to see William Black's article that he did with another person, I don't remember the name, about putting Bank of America right now into receivership?
Yeah, and he's done a series of articles. The latest one I saw, he was taking Obama to task after his Daily Show performance, where he basically said, heck of a job, Larry. So, Obama has had his G.W. Bush moment. But, it's just sad, you know, and it's sad to see that he's not really a big reformer in this sense. He's buying into the neoliberal bankster complex, and that's just sad to see. But I wanted to ask you about
talk a little bit, please, so that people can understand about why we need to put Bank of America into receiver.
Well, they're a locus of a lot of what went on here in terms of
locus, like an locusd or locus or both.
Locus. If you prefer locus, yeah, that was a big depression metaphor there. But they did a lot of this, creating these dodgy loans, and unfortunately they entered into liability for a lot more of it by scarfing up Merrill Lynch and Countrywide, eagerly or not so eagerly. But it's big companies, big banks like that can't just get off the hook of all those liabilities by saying, oh, we were just taking over another company. And so now they find themselves subject to lawsuits and putbacks, including from the New York Fed. And that segues into something else I wanted to bring up, which is that for if there's any left-leaning folks out there listening, and I'm not sure if there are,
let's hope somebody is listening with both left and right ears, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't buy into this.
What is it that
much? But the item is AFL-CIO counsel Damon Silvers in a congressional hearing, a TARP hearing the other day, blasting the Treasury for trying to say there was no systemic risk, and he singled out Bank of America as an example. But then he pointed out that the New York Fed itself is trying to put many of these bad loans, mortgage-backed securities, back on the Bank of America because it found them to be fraud-ridden, and then contradicting itself, saying there's no problem with institutions like that, even though these putbacks will cost them billions. He gave an estimate of over $20 billion. So,
to follow up with you, Aaron, do you remember reading back in February of 2008, and Danny's In Debt We Trust got me started on this, Bank of America was quietly shopping the halls of Congress in February of 2008 for a $789 billion bailout package just for them.
Right. That wouldn't surprise me.
So why, you know all about the prompt corrective recovery, correct?
Yes. Right.
So why are we not implementing that?
Well, I think the attitude is that it would just cause too much shock to the establishment. And the way that people like Hank Paulson put it was that, oh, it's going, you know, if we corrected all these things at once, like we should, and like prompt corrective action, for instance, mandates, that it would tank the economy. But really, I mean, the economy is tanked for Main Street already. So
yeah.
If you're in Main Street, you know, you're already in so much pain in this economy. What it would tank is the control of the banksters on these big institutions. And probably a lot of people in the present class of Congress. So that
Aaron, let me just explain to our friend from China here, Jing Ning, what the word bankster means. Do you want to explain that? I don't think she's heard that before.
Bankster is a term that was coined, I believe, in the Great Depression as a way of drawing the attention to big banks and big banking interests like J.P. Morgan and his fellow major money center bankers that you may or may not have been pulling major shenanigans and foreclosing on people and taking advantage of the depression. And so we find, I think, distinctly a similar situation now. Probably
we call them
worse.
Banksters, like the word gangsters, except
right.
with a B.
It was coined by Ferdinand Pecora during his commission hearings, because that was during the time of Prohibition, with all of the gangsters, and so Pecora called them banksters because they were just as bad.
Well, there you go. I just wanted to clarify that. I don't know how you would. Is there a word in Chinese like banksters?
I'm not quite sure. I don't think so. Seriously, I don't think so.
Well, let's see if we can get one introduced, okay, into the Chinese language. Then a lot of people will pick up on it. Maybe we should Twitter it, tweet it in China. I don't know if you know the artist Ai Wei, but he uses tweeting a lot. And maybe that's one way of getting a viral pickup of the word bankster in China. I think people there would appreciate it, because actually I found that people in China have a pretty good sense of humor, which is one way of coping with the absurdities that they live in. And we in our society are doing it as well. Aaron, will you be going to the Sanity Rally and checking it out?
Yeah, most likely.
So I wish.
Aaron, I have a question. What do we need to do in conjunction with Danny's petition? How do we hold these people accountable? Because this isn't a scandal; it's theft of epic proportion.
Right. Well, we need to, when we're in facing foreclosure in these situations, or even not. I know people that are pushing to get proof of note ownership from their bank, even though they're perfectly fine with their mortgage and they can afford it. They want to force the bank to show that it's done the paperwork properly. So anyone can go out and do that. And there are templates online for the requests that you can send to your mortgage servicer. Of course, if you're facing foreclosure, fight it and at least make sure that the bank does its diligence. Direct your money towards small community banks and credit unions if you can. And, of course, keep raising these issues in the election. Both parties need to really we can't tiptoe around this. Feeding into this.
I want to just say, because, there are political differences between Aaron and myself, but I really appreciate and respect his insight into all of this. It's not cluttered with sort of knee-jerk ideology. It's really fact-based, and it's important. His site, ml-implode.com, you really have to check it out and have to support this site, because it does such an excellent job of covering the economy. If you want to see our petition, it will be up sometime soon, I don't know exactly when, on Plunder, thecrimeofourtime.com, which is the website for my film Plunder and the book The Crime of Our Time. You can reach me at dissector@mediachannel.org, and you can also read my blog at newsdissector.com/blog. So, and I'm also posting articles here on the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com site. This program will be available as a podcast that you can download from the website, and you can also send it to your friends. So we want to thank you again for joining us. Thank you to Sherry Welch, to Aaron Crown, to Greg Palast, to our special guest here, Jing Ning, who is from Rutgers University, who came across the Hudson, the mighty Hudson today, swimming like Mao once did in the Yangtze River across the Hudson to be with us. And we're really happy that you're here. We're going to go out now with another song about the foreclosure crisis. It's the oldest song in American history. It's called There's No Place Like Home. Okay, what do we have? The regular version. Let's do it.
And we also want to thank Ellen Brown, Web of Deceit.
There you go. Ellen was on with us earlier. So that's the News Dissector Radio Hour this week. Thank you to the ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Thank you for listening, and join us next week.
Life is beautiful.